Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. Our speaker is Brown University Professor Melanie Kamet. Professor Kamet's lecture is titled The Arab Uprisings and Political Change in the Middle East. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Augustus Richard Norton, from the Department of International Relations at Boston University.
I'm very pleased tonight to have a very impressive social scientist with us. This is Professor Melanie Kamet, who's come from Brown University, where she's on the faculty. She did her PhD work at Berkeley in California, and her first book was on business and globalization in the Middle East. And her second book, which is in progress, is called Compassionate Communalism, and it's a very interesting study of the provision of social services, for example, medical care, by a variety of groups, including religious-oriented groups. She's just back from the Middle East. She's recently in Turkey. But apropos of tonight's lecture, she was recently in Tunisia. What I think first comes to mind when I think of Melanie Kamet is someone who has very fine training for understanding the Middle East, good Arabic, good understanding of regional history and politics, but she also is well-trained as a social scientist. So she brings a deep familiarity with the region to bear with very good juice of concepts and ideas. So the result is you get really rigorous research findings from Melanie Kamet. And I'm sure we'll hear some sample of that tonight. Thank you very much for coming, Melanie.
Well, thank you so much to Professor Norton and to BU for hosting me and also for that very generous and kind introduction. So today I'm going to talk about Tunisia, and I'm really delighted to be thinking about Tunisia again because I had spent over a year living there back in 2000 when I did my doctoral dissertation research, which turned into part of my first book. And I thought after I left then, I thought, I am just never going to come back to this place. It was so repressive. It was so difficult to do field work, even on relatively innocuous topics. I said, I'll never come back unless there's regime change, and that will never happen. So, ha, ha, ha. But lo and behold, it did happen. And I'm, I suppose, embarrassed to say that it took me by surprise, but it took lots of people by surprise. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the broad brush of events that have been occurring in the Middle East since the Arab uprisings were touched off actually in Tunisia back in December 2010 when a produce seller, Mohamed Bouazizi, set himself on fire and sparked the Tunisian uprising, which then spread across the region. So there's no need to go into details there. But I want to talk about what's been going on in Tunisia since then, because I think it's really remarkable, not just in light of what Tunisia was like before all of this began. I think you probably have an understanding that it was an extremely repressive place, despite the fact that it had a pretty good image in the West as being a quote-unquote moderate country with a sort of pleasant atmosphere. So I want to talk about what's been going on, because it really is historic. And I think we have a lot to learn about processes of regime change from the Tunisian example. So as you may know, the former president dictator of Tunisia, Ben Ali, was kicked out in January 2011. And prior to that, he had taken power in 1987 in a bloodless coup. Prior to that, Tunisia was ruled by a man named Habib Bourguiba, who was in power from 1956 until Ben Ali deposed him in 1987. So we're talking about 55 years of authoritarian rule since Tunisia gained independence. And in October 2011 of last year, Tunisia held its first elections after Ben Ali was deposed for a constitutional assembly that was going to rewrite the rules of the game. I was actually in Tunisia at that time. I just have a few photos up from my trip there. I went a few weeks before the elections to kind of get the lay of the land and see how politics was unfolding and to witness the elections and gain a better understanding of political dynamics in the new Tunisia. Tunisians are, you know, rightfully very proud of what they pulled off in October of 2011. These were historic elections with, you know, very peaceful. There were no real irregularities. They were judged free and fair by international and domestic observers. And the turnout was respectable. It was not absolutely overwhelming. It sort of depends on how you count it. So if you only count registered voters, the turnout was high, 90%. But actually, if you count all eligible voters, the turnout was about 51%, which is respectable. That's not a terrible number, but not quite as high as people were projecting on the eve of the elections. And people waited for hours and hours, you know, off in the hot sun to go vote. And there was really a feeling of joy, a sense of joy at the polling stations. I accompanied a friend to one polling station, and everyone was just in tears and hugging each other. It was really a momentous occasion. And so this was really, I think, indicative of how the process has been going by and large, with some important bumps on the road that I'll talk about. And it is important to note that not only was this a victory in the context of, you know, 55 years of dictatorship, but also right after the uprisings began, there were months and months of protests, and things were not entirely clear-cut. It was not sort of a foregone conclusion that things would go smoothly. You know, the old regime tried to hold on to power. There were snipers and thugs out. People lost their lives during the demonstrations. You know, families of victims are actually still looking for justice for people who lost their lives during the uprising. So it wasn't an entirely rosy process. It wasn't a sort of bloodless overthrow entirely. There was sort of much to and fro occurring after, leading up to Ben Ali's departure and after he left Tunisia. But nonetheless, the fact that these elections were pulled off smoothly sets a really important regional precedent, I think. And also, as we're watching events unfold in other countries, Tunisia provides an important contrast. So if you're watching what's going on in Egypt, for example, things look relatively rosy in Tunisia. In Egypt, things are, you know, meeting important obstacles, particularly in the form of the military council, the Supreme Council, that is not particularly excited about giving up power. And so the uprisings are still very much in progress, lots of demonstrations going on, and protests to oust the military, and also discussions of whether the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which has really gained the plurality of votes in the recent elections, discussions about whether they are making backroom deals with the military and so forth. So things are much less clear and smooth in Egypt than in Tunisia, and of course, suffice it to say, than in Syria and other places in the region. I want to talk a little bit about how Tunisia got there. These are just some more photos from the campaign period. It was absolutely shocking to me to be in Tunisia and see people out there speaking freely about politics, passing out literature, campaigning, posters on the wall with party platforms articulated in some detail. It was really quite a contrast. There was incredible graffiti on the walls. If you have ever spent time in Tunisia under Ben Ali, this was really a shocking experience. This was actually a press conference that I attended several days before the elections took place, by Ennahda, which is the Islamist party that won the plurality of votes. I'll talk about that shortly. This is Rashid Ghannouchi, the head of Ennahda, and this is Hamed Ijbali, who is now prime minister of Tunisia, both important figures in the organization. Also campaign rallies. I went on the Friday night before the elections. Every party had their sort of end of campaign rally. So I was sort of campaign rally hopping that evening to get a sense of the comparative turnout. It was actually rather deceptive. It was not a good, fair sample because I was in the greater Tunis area. So all these secular leftist parties had great turnout. If you were only judging, you know, drawing your inferences from what was going on in Tunisia, you might have thought that the secular leftists were going to do really well. But actually, as I'll talk about in a minute, they didn't do so well. So my party hopping in Tunisia was not a representative sample of what was, or in Tunis was not a representative sample of what was going on across the country. So I want to talk a little bit about how Tunisia got to these elections and what's been going on afterwards, and then some of the big issues that are that are facing Tunisia and are arguably facing other places as well. Again, the process was pretty impressive in terms of sort of the institutional progression. And this is really important because how the rules are made in the immediate aftermath of a revolution or a change in power are very important because they really decide sort of who's going to get a seat at the table. And in fact, who gets a seat at the table in the first place in writing those rules is really critical, because I think it's almost axiomatic that those folks that sit at the table are not entirely looking out for their conception of the public good. They're also interested in furthering their own interests. So who gets a seat at the table in the immediate process of writing the rules is really critical, and I think it's a process worth paying a lot of attention to. So what happened was, shortly after the dust settled, a commission was established. It has a very long name, the High Commission for the Fulfillment of Revolutionary Goals, Political Reform, and Democratic Transition. We'll call it the High Commission. So the High Commission was established, as well as other commissions. There was also a Human Rights Commission and a Corruption Commission established, because Ben Ali and his wife's family, the Trabelsi family, were very much involved in a lot of corruption in Tunisia, particularly since the mid to late 1990s. So there were a lot of cases to be heard related to corruption issues and irregular economic practices. So it's really important to pay attention to how this commission got constituted. And I think the story, from my perspective, still is a little bit fuzzy, but it's a very important story, and I'll tell you the sort of basic contours of the story. So this commission was appointed by the government right after the revolution. And from the perspective of Islamists whom I spoke to in Tunisia, this was an unfair process because the decks were stacked against them. Basically, the council had about 80 to 100 members, or of the membership in the council, a significant majority were composed of leftists or ex-communists, and many were members of the Communist Party, the Tajdid. And how these people got into that position was not entirely clear. Someone in the office of the interim prime minister appointed them, and then someone, when the interim prime minister changed, someone continued to appoint these people. And it's not entirely clear who those people were that were doing the appointing, but from the perspective of the Islamists, this was not a fair process because they were not represented in this commission. It started with 40 members, and then what happened was a number of political parties, including Ennahda, the major Islamist party, as well as the labor union and various civil society organizations, said, hey, we want a seat at the table too. And so what happened was the council increased in size to about 150 members. And again, Islamists were claiming that leftists had an advantage in getting appointed to the council in the first place. So what happened was, despite these objections, Ennahda decided to join the commission. And one of the conditions on which it agreed to join this commission was that decisions would be taken by consensus, not by majority rule. So you can imagine why they'd have an interest in that, given that they did not constitute the majority. And there were various bumps on the road here. At a certain point in May or June, Ennahda pulled out of this council or this commission altogether. I think one of the major issues had to do with financing, campaign financing, or party budgets. So a number of members of the High Commission said, let's put a cap on party budgets This was clearly a move in favor of some of the smaller secular leftist parties who had smaller resource endowments and organizational apparatuses. Ennahda said, no way, you're trying to basically clip our wings. So they said, we're going to pull out of this. So that was one major issue. Also, the council, this commission in May, appointed the members of the Electoral Commission that were going to oversee the whole electoral process. And again, Ennahda was not happy with who the members of this Electoral Council were. So they had a number of issues with what was going on. There was a lot of tension. They thought that the elections were actually going to be rigged by their leftist secular opponents. So more negotiations ensued. They finally decided to join the commission again and take part in the elections. And apparently one of the factors, a major factor that made them rejoin, was that they achieved a guarantee that they could put a representative at each ballot box in every polling station. And that's an interesting thing because it shows their organizational strength across the country. No other party in Tunisia that contested these elections really had enough members to be able to put representatives at each ballot box because there were thousands of polling stations. But they wanted to do this because they were worried that the elections were going to be stolen from them, and they had a pretty good sense that they were going to come out on top. In fact, right before the elections, there were all these predictions and pronouncements by senior Ennahda officials saying, we're going to get a majority, not just a plurality. They stepped back a little bit right before the election from that prediction. So these elections were held on October 23rd, and I just want to briefly talk about the results as a way to sort of lead into who's in power there and the dynamics of politics at the moment. So the Constitutional Assembly is composed of 217 seats. There were 27 domestic districts, as you can see here, but also four external districts in France and other places. I think France might have had two districts. I'm not sure. And so Ennahda, this Islamist party I've been talking about, did quite well in these elections. They received 41% of the seats, that's 89 seats, with about 39% of the votes cast. The other parties, clearly did far worse than Ennahda did. I mean, not that they did horribly, but there was a real gap between the first and the second party. And I just want to take a second, actually, to talk about the electoral rules, not in too much detail because it gets kind of technical and nitty-gritty, but it's kind of important to understand how we interpret these results. So the system that was employed in the elections is what we call closed-list proportional representation. So basically, you as the voter go to the polls and you click off, you check an entire party list. You don't have the option to pick candidates from different lists. Maybe some of you have taken political science classes where you talk about this or are just interested in this stuff and know about this. There was another little closed list PR can be configured in a number of different ways. And the particular way that the High Commission chose was called closed list PR with highest remainder. And I will not go into the details about how you calculate that, but the idea behind that particular system is to achieve greater representation and give more parties the opportunity to be represented, and also to encourage parties to develop coherent party lists so that you're not really voting for candidates so much, you're voting for parties and party platforms. But again, one of the major goals was to encourage lots of inclusion in the Constitutional Assembly. Because here, again, you've got this founding body that's going to rewrite the rules of the game. They're going to write the Constitution. That's what this election was about. It was to elect a body that is going to rewrite the Constitution. So the goal was to include as many folks in this process as possible. But what happened was it didn't quite work out like that, because what happened was tons of people decided to start political parties. So there was a very lax rule determining who could start a political party, how you could start a political party. So in some districts, you as a voter would go to the polling station and see a list of 100 parties that you could check off. So incredibly overwhelming, even if you have lots of political knowledge of what's going on. I mean, it's just not possible to, you know, attain information on all of those parties. And so what happened was the votes actually got kind of diluted. And so those parties that got more votes actually were advantaged in this system. So it kind of backfired a little, and you didn't get quite as much representation. And so that's background to Ennahda winning quite a large number of seats. And in fact, Ennahda placed number one in the results in all of these districts except for one. In fact, I think it was the district where Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire. And in general, if we had to sort of make sweeping assessments of how these results played out, in general, I think it's fair to say that parties that had longer organizational roots did better. So parties that were more familiar had been around longer. That's not a terribly shocking result. And also, parties that did not employ anti-Islamist, anti-Ennahda rhetoric, really virulent rhetoric against the party. And I want to talk about that a little bit more. So again, Ennahda comes in first. The second party, just to go back here, was something we call the CPR, which is headed by a guy named Monsef Marzouki. And he is now currently president of Tunisia under the deal that's been worked out. He has a reputation for being sort of honest and clean, really running on an anti-corruption human rights platform. And he's an interesting guy. Back in 1990, in the early 1990s, Ben Ali, the former president, was really cracking down hard on the Islamists. After he took power in 87, there was sort of a Tunisian spring where politics opened up and things were more pluralistic. I'm told by Tunisian colleagues that actually politics back then looked similar to politics today in Tunisia. Really, a lot of open, free expression. And so this ended after a couple of years, especially after Ennahda, which had decided to contest elections in the 1989 elections, won seats in the parliament. So Ben Ali said, we're not going to have this. And he really brutally cracked down on the Islamists. I mean, brutally. To the point where they were either dead in prison, in exile, or just hiding out. You did not have a sense that there were Islamists in Tunisia when you did field work there in 2000. So it's, you know, this is an important point because it's rather shocking that Islamists are, for all intents and purposes, wiped out of the political scene, and then they have a resounding victory in 2011. So Marzouki is an interesting guy because when this crackdown was occurring, he actually spoke up and said, this is not right, and you, Ben Ali, need to abide by the rule of law. And this guy is not an Islamist. He's a sort of secular progressive type. So he is not himself an Islamist, but he believed in the principle that they should be able to participate and, of course, should not be killed and imprisoned and so forth. Needless to say, Ben Ali did not appreciate this advice. Then he went on to found various human rights organizations, and in 2001 formed this organization, the Congress for the Republic Party, the CPR, which was then promptly banned the following year, and he went into exile in France. But over the course of this, he developed a reputation for being a fair-minded guy, for being really committed to human rights, and for speaking up even for Islamists when they are suppressed. So this was useful when the elections occurred in terms of understanding how the results played out and how he got to be president. Another important party is At-Takattul, which is the third partner in the coalition right now. So the three parties that really have the most ministers, in fact, the only parties that have ministers in the current Tunisian government are Ennahda, the CPR, and At-Takattul. The other members of the cabinet are independents. So Takattul did actually much worse than they expected. They were not happy with the results, but still were able to bring an important block of votes considering and were involved in negotiations with Anata leading to the formation of the cabinet. And this party at Tzakatl is headed by a guy named Mustafa Ben Jafar, who also has a long-standing history of being committed to human rights and being in opposition to first Bourguiba and then Ben Ali. And in fact, his party was legalized under Ben Ali's regime and held a few seats in parliament. And then in 2009, he had the audacity to actually try to run for president against Ben Ali. Needless to say, Ben Ali won. But so this guy also had a pretty good reputation in terms of being a committed opposition figure and standing for human rights issues. Now, those parties, I won't go into great detail in the interest of time, but those parties that really ran on a strong anti-Ennahda platform did more poorly. So I'm thinking of the PDP and the POL party. I'm happy to talk about those later if you're interested. One of them, the PDP, there were accusations that some of its members had connections to the former regime, which didn't help it too much either. And then there was this party called Arida Shabia, which is a long story, and it's kind of a dark horse party and has been excluded from the negotiations in forming the government, but there were some irregularities with the way that party campaigned and so forth. So I want to talk a little bit about why Ennahda did so well and then some of the challenges that are facing Tunisia right now and then put it sort of in broader perspective. So again, we shouldn't exaggerate how well it did. We shouldn't say, you know, it had a sweeping victory and just overwhelming massive popular support, because remember, I said only 50% of the population voted, and the way the rules were written, they actually sort of favored those parties, especially Ennahda, that won more seats. But nonetheless, the parties clearly has strong appeal across the country, and not just in the poor and marginalized districts of the central and southern regions of Tunisia, but also in the coastal areas that are wealthier, where you see more educated populations and so forth. And again, it was the highest seat winner in all districts except for in Sidi Bouzid. So, you know, we can speculate about why Ennahda has such appeal. And I think it's an interesting question, again, in light of the fact that they had been so repressed and really wiped off the political map. So one is clearly the party had a good amount of legitimacy because of the very fact that it was repressed. Now, you could say, well, other parties had that too, but certainly not to the same degree as the Islamists. Really serious torture. I believe Hamadi Jbali, the current prime minister, might have spent something like 12 or 15 years in prison under Ben Ali, and this is not a unique story. Many people spent many years in prison. Ghannouchi was in exile, as were other major figures in Ennahda, many of them in London, actually. Others were just sort of keeping quiet. So a lot of repression, and this is clearly a source of legitimacy. Some of those other parties had people who had participated in Ben Ali's governments. Even if they weren't active party members, they did consent to maybe take a cabinet post or a position in government, and this clearly cost them some credibility. Also, Ennahda, like many other Islamist parties across the region, has a reputation for being honest and not corrupt. This is also true for Ettakatl and the CPR, so it's not unique to Ennahda, but certainly it is true of Ennahda, like other Islamist parties. There's also the simple fact that they ran a really professional campaign. They did a really good job. I mean, they got out there, they were all over the country, and again, remember I mentioned they had the organizational power to be all over the country in a way that other parties didn't. But they did they ran a very good campaign. And I had a number of interviews with Ennahda officials, and I asked them the question, how are you organizing so effectively, being that you were so repressed? I mean, really, again, I spent a year living in Tunisia, and I didn't notice the Islamists, and people weren't talking about the Islamists as a major force in politics there, or any force in politics. And they said to me, we were always there. We were in the neighborhoods. People knew who we were, and people respected the way we lived, the simple, straightforward ways we lived. One Nahda official was telling me that actually they had a lot of sort of covert members in the civil service, in the bureaucracy, in ministries within the government, and they were just sort of being quiet about their sympathies and affiliations, but they apparently had a lot of supporters who were quite aware of their sympathies during this period of repression. It also seems evident that something about the message of Ennahda resonates in the population. Clearly, there's something about what they're saying that speaks to the population, and this, came out in some of the debates over free speech that occurred in the campaign period. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then I would argue that they also benefited from some of the really strong attacks on religious values and religion in politics by some of the other staunchly secularist parties, because there was a lot of very sharp rhetoric critiquing them and questioning their credentials and questioning their intentions. You may have heard about these accusations, one man, one vote, one time, with regard to Islamist parties. And so there was a lot of fear on the part of opponents that Ennahda would take power and then sort of rule by decree. So lots of accusations that might have not resonated so well with members of the population. So let me talk a little bit about the way politics are playing out and how the sort of institution building process is proceeding. And again, I mean, this might be just my sort of nerdy political scientist side, but I find this process absolutely fascinating because it's so important in sort of setting in motion political dynamics that may have legacies lasting for years and years and years. So in November, just several months ago, November 2011, the Constitutional Assembly met for the first time. And their priority, of course, was to decide on a method for electing an interim president and a cabinet, and that proceeded pretty smoothly. I mean, I mentioned that Marzouki is president. I forgot to mention that Mustafa Ben Jafar from Attaqatl is a key figure in the government as well, and Hamadi Jbali from Ennahda is the prime minister, the acting prime minister. So the Constitutional Assembly had to come to some agreement about how this was going to occur, and keep in mind you had some disgruntled parties that really didn't get very many votes as well. So, and Ennahda made it very clear during this process that they weren't going to try to monopolize all cabinet positions, despite the fact that they had a very clear plurality and had won so many more seats than other parties. So the Constitutional Assembly also had to do more mundane things, but important things like approve the budget for 2012 and so forth. And there were lots of ambiguities leading up to the election and after the election about what exactly this Constitutional Assembly was going to do, what was the length of its tenure, and so forth. So this government was formed successfully in December. And again, ministers from Ennahda, the CPR, and Attaqatl formed the vast majority of the cabinet members. And now we're starting to see the process of writing the constitution unfold. So in January, Ben Jafar from Attaqatl was appointed the president of the commission to draft this the constitution. And this actually led to some more controversies because Ennahda said, wait a second, we want our guy there as the head of this commission that's going to write the constitution. But then Attaqatl and the CPR said, we're out. We're stepping out of the assembly if you push this. And so there was a compromise, and Jafar was retained the position. So now this process is going on. I mean, really, right now it's going on. And there's been a number of draft constitutions submitted by different parties. I heard at one point that there were 42 drafts submitted for consideration. So there's a lot of stuff to consider here. And in mid-February, the Constitutional Assembly had the first official meeting to work on drafting the Constitution. They set up 6 different subcommittees or commissions that are going to work on different parts of writing this Constitution. And interestingly, when you look at the composition of these subcommittees and who heads them, it's not just a Tekotl, CPR, and Ennahda. You have heads of committees from some of those other leftist parties and secular parties that didn't get much representation and are not in the cabinet. Very recently, I mean, I think actually yesterday, there was a conflict that emerged in this process over the role of Islamic law in the Constitution. We knew this was coming. This is a big issue. It's an issue that's been discussed in Egypt as well. What is the position of Islamic law in the Constitution? So the language is very sensitive. Are you going to say that Islamic law is a source of law or the source of law? That's really an important distinction. Some members of Ennahda, I can't say for sure that every single member of Ennahda, because there are different factions in Ennahda, some members have argued that Sharia, Islamic law, should be the principal source of legislation. That's the quote that I saw. So this is very worrisome to some of the secular groups, and it's a real point of contention going on right now. I mean, I saw the news report yesterday that this is being debated. So this, I think, raises a larger question about, you know, should secularists be afraid of the Islamists? And it's a very important question. Secularists, as I've alluded to already, are concerned that Ennahda is essentially a wolf in sheep's clothing. So it's going to come in, play the moderate game, use the nice rhetoric, but really try to push through a hardcore version of Islamic law and that it has authoritarian tendencies. And they point back to some experiences that occurred or some events that occurred in the early 1990s during this period of repression under Ben Ali. So apparently, there was attack on the ruling party headquarters back in the early 1990s by some folks who were affiliated with Ennahda. And in the process, a person who was, I believe, a guard at the ruling party office was killed. And this was took place in the middle of the night, so there weren't a lot of staff members there. Ennahda claims that this was not an act sanctioned by the higher-ups in the organization, that at that time in the organization there was a lot of sort of disparate groups running around, and because they were being so repressed, it was difficult to maintain centralized authority over different factions in the organization. So that's their perspective on it. And the secularists claim that this is, you know, not really a good representation of what was going on, and that Ennahda did not sufficiently forcefully condemn the violence that took place during those attacks. So that's been a bone of contention and has been one of the factors that secularists cite as sort of indicative of Ennahda tendencies. They also point to various pronouncements. They claim that Ghannouchi and others in the leadership of Ennahda use a kind of double speak. So they speak in moderate terms towards, you know, broader audiences, but in more extremist terms towards their base. The counter argument is that actually Ennahda is a moderate Islamist organization. And in fact, Rashid Ghannouchi is known for his writings on the compatibility of Islam and democracy and the importance of human rights and the renunciation of violence. When you see interviews or discussions by the Turkish Islamist Party, the AK Party that is currently in power, many of the leaders of that party say that they were inspired by the writings of Rashid Ghannouchi. So there is this track record of writing on democracy and Islam and nonviolence and so forth. And in fact, I think it's important to keep in mind that Ennahda, just like any political organization, has different wings and different factions. So, you know, there are more extremist elements that critics claim are, you know, have violent tendencies. Ennahda claims those are not part of their organization. Those are other more extremist groups that they are not related to. There are also sort of older generations of moderates and younger generations of moderates. And some people have predicted that when Ennahda is really in power and is, you know, plays the political game over time, it will actually split into different parties. And we've seen this actually with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, that they're splitting off into different parties. So Ennahda claims that it is a moderate organization. It often cites the Turkish example and says, you know, we're similar to those guys. but there are some really serious issues on the table right now that I want to bring up. And some of them, I find it really hard to figure out how they can be reconciled or resolved. So one is this question of freedom of expression. How many of you have heard of this incident where a television station in Tunisia aired the film Persepolis, and this led to some violent attacks? Okay. So a couple of you heard about this. Back in October, a television station called Nesma, which is not an Islamist television station, chose to air the animated film Persepolis. Have you guys seen this film? Have many of you seen this film? So you may recall that there is a dream sequence scene when a young girl dreams about God and sees the face of God, and the face of God is actually depicted in the film. So this is very offensive to many people of the Muslim faith, and Islamists in Tunisia were greatly offended, as were many people in society. This actually sparked a violent attack by some extremists. It's not clear who exactly they belong to, but Ennahda says they are not part of Ennahda. They actually attacked the home of the owner of the television station and set it on fire, and he escaped out the back door with his wife and children. And now there's actually a case in court, I believe, accusing this man of blasphemy. And so this case is being heard, and it's very controversial. In fact, a Tunisian, there was a story in the New York Times about this a couple months ago when some friends and colleagues of this television station owner and others who are participating in the trial went to show their solidarity at the court proceedings. They were actually attacked by some folks on the street outside of the courtroom. And this was caught on video and circulated around YouTube, and it's become a big issue. So, you know, apart from the violence and counterattacks, and you've had marches by secularist groups demanding full freedom of speech and the right to air things that might be deemed offensive to some but not to others, you know, apart from these sort of counterattacks going back and forth, I think this, you know, this raises a really tough question about freedom of speech, where you have extremely different views of what is permissible in the public sphere in the new Tunisia. Ennahda officials that I've spoken to said, you know, this is just not acceptable. We should not have films like this aired on television stations. And I should also mention that I believe the film was dubbed into Tunisian dialect, which was deemed even more offensive. So officials from Ennahda said, look, we don't condone violence. We don't think violence is an appropriate response to this, but it is not acceptable to air this kind of offensive material in the public sphere. And so what you have are secular liberal groups saying, you don't have to watch the film, but please don't tell us what, you know, we can say or do in public. And so you can imagine that this is an extremely difficult situation, almost intractable, and clearly requires some very serious dialogue across ideological lines. I'm not sure how precisely you can reconcile this. I mean, if you imagine a Venn diagram, I don't think there's too much space in the middle of these two circles. So it's a very difficult question. There's also very recent issues about Islamic dress in public, the niqab, so women fully covered. Some university professors at the University of Manuba near Tunis have said, you know, we will not teach students who are fully covered, whose faces we cannot see at all. Apparently, I believe this is a university regulation. And so at least one woman has showed up to class in the full niqab. And the professor said, we just simply will not conduct courses under these circumstances. And then there have been demonstrations and so forth outside of the university by more extremist organizations or activists. There's also the question of Salafists, so more, for lack of a better word, extremist Islamist organizations that really are very firmly committed to a particular, more orthodox view of Islamic law and want that to be the guiding principle in Tunisian society. And there are these groups that have been popping up, some of whom use violence, espouse violence as an appropriate method. And they are likely the folks who are perpetrating these acts of violence that I referred to. And these groups have popped up. This is a new phenomenon in Tunisia, again, coming out of a period of repression. In particular, there's this one organization, Hizb Tahrir, which was actually banned from participating in the elections for the Constitutional Assembly. So just yesterday, I believe, President Marzouki came out publicly on a Lebanese talk show and said, I support the participation of the Salafists in elections. I support the formation of a legalized political party by the Salafists. And so we can speculate about why he came out with that statement. I would imagine that part of it has to do with his longstanding commitment to human rights and inclusion and so forth. And so just out of principle, he believes that there should be as much inclusion in the political sphere. I would wonder also whether he's got this social science theory in the back of his head that inclusion in mainstream politics leads to more moderation. That is an argument out there. It's a contested argument, but that's an argument out there in political science that some political scientists have made. So perhaps that's part of his calculation as well. And there is some evidence that that works in some cases, although there's others that argue that you, as a party, have to make the decision to want to take part in elections and mainstream politics in the first place before you actually do so, and therefore you moderate before you are included. So it's a contested argument, but some people have made that claim. So just to wrap up, I'll just make a few brief comments. First is, I think Tunisia, in comparative perspective, is probably the closest thing to what we can say revolution, is a revolution. And I say this, with trepidation and great respect for Egypt, because I know that this has really angered some Egyptians who have participated in the protests, because they say, look, we have a revolution here as well. And, there is an amazing turn of events in Egypt. But if you stick with a very strict definition of revolution, according to, changing the rules of the game, we could say at best that Egypt is a revolution in progress, because the military has always been a very important critical actor in the government, and it remains so today. It has not relinquished its power as of yet. And so in sort of regional comparative terms, Tunisia looks like a relative success case. And I think it's, I'm starting to think about these questions and starting to think about writing an article on this. And I think there's a number of reasons why this might be the case. One is that you do have these very developed organizations like the CPR and Tekatl and the labor union in particular, the UGTT, which I didn't talk about but was a key actor in the uprisings. These actors have long-standing roots, and they have wide appeal in Tunisian society. I mean, the UGTT is extremely active to this day, holding demonstrations even, I think, in the last 24 hours. And so you have a diversity of parties with diverse perspectives that are forced to bargain with each other. They have real roots in society. And so I think that has facilitated this process of institution building. Also, the arguably Ennahda, the dominant Islamist party on the scene, has a pretty long track record of saying that it's committed to democratic principles. Now, we can debate what that means in practice and have this discussion about what true intentions are and so forth, but it does, Ghannouchi has a long track record of these writings. and they've sort of bound themselves with rhetoric to the argument that they want to play by the political rules and share power. There's also the question of the role of the military in Tunisia versus other countries. The military has never been a big power broker in Tunisia. It just isn't the powerful actor that it is in Egypt and is in Syria, for that matter. And you didn't have situations with Bourguiba and Ben Ali stacking the military with their family members or cronies. And so you don't have that kind of force in Tunisian politics that might, under different circumstances, try to stall the process or hold on to privileges that it's accrued over time. So I think that these are, you know, sort of some factors to consider in thinking about why Tunisia appears to be proceeding rather smoothly. But I think these debates between Islamists and secularists are really serious debates that are going to keep popping up. Also, really, I think the most important issue facing Tunisia and all of the countries across the region, particularly the non-oil economies, are the very serious economic problems facing these countries. I mean, we all know there's just enormous youth unemployment. If you look at comparative data on Middle East, North Africa versus other global regions, the level of youth unemployment is just off the charts. And you can't absorb that without serious economic growth and a more balanced path of economic development. And I think there are very serious challenges facing Tunisia and other countries in trying to achieve those levels of growth and development to address these really serious problems. Thanks for having me.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Brown University Professor Melanie Kamet. Professor Kamet's lecture was titled The Arab Uprisings and Political Change in the Middle East and was presented by the Boston University Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. Tonight's moderator was Professor Augustus Richard Norton from the Department of International Relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.